This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Grant. Two new Virginia-based studies are giving us some insight into the state of the American family. One examines an all-important element of attachment at issue, the possible strain on very young children when they're shuttled back and forth between different households because parents don't live together. Psychologist Robert Emery is one of the chief architects of this investigation, and he's agreed to tell us more. The other report looks at some significant trends in marriage, primarily how changes in our economy are affecting people's decisions about getting married. Sociologist Sarah Corse co-authored that investigation. She's here with us, too. And then there's you. What does the term family mean to you? Has your understanding been changing, evolving in any way? Your questions and insights will certainly be most welcome when our conversation begins right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Some of us got our definition of family watching Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver, or maybe The Simpsons. But if we put media-sponsored and even culturally embedded mythologies aside, what does family mean to you? Is your definition evolving? What part does marriage play? And who is responsible for trying to assure that children grow up in as safe, healthy, and nurturing an environment as possible? If you've got thoughts on any of these questions, we'd love to hear from you. By phone, we're at 888-WMRA-TALK. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. We have two guests with us to help here in the Insight studio with me, sociologist Sarah Corse. Dr. Corse, thank you so very much for making time for us.
My pleasure.
And joining us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, psychologist Robert Emery. Dr. Emery, welcome.
Delighted to be here, Tom.
Well, Dr. Corse, let's go to you first. Some of your latest research is on the changing nature of marriage and how America's changing economic conditions are affecting marriage. So could you give us a quick overview of your findings?
Sure. One of the things we were interested in the study I completed with my co-author, Jen Silva, is getting a little qualitative data, talking to people, to help us understand some of the statistics we've been seeing lately. Those statistics show us that in the last 20 years or so, middle-class people, and that means people with a college degree, as we define it, are much more likely to get married, to stay married, and particularly to have their children within the bounds of marriage than are people with less education. So we wanted to try and understand why that was true. We interviewed just about 300 people all across America, both people without college degrees and people with college degrees, to try to talk to them about their intimate relationships, their history of relationships, their desires for relationships, their marriages, their possible divorces, and also to get them to talk to us a little about their children, if they had children. And one of the things we found is that both working class people in America and middle class people are interested in having intimate relationships and being involved often in marriage relationships, but their ability to sustain marriage is quite different. And for working class people, work has become increasingly insecure and unstable. So people have a hard time finding jobs that pay a living wage, and they have a hard time finding work that's going to produce a stable income over time that they can rely on.
Sarah, from what I've read of your research, it seems to me that that second point, not that the first isn't important, but that second is all important, that what has really changed for people who don't have a high school degree or have a high school degree but don't have a college degree is the availability of employment, say a union factory job, that they felt assured would stay with them as long as they wanted to keep working. That over the past few decades, those kinds of jobs have largely disappeared. And so security about work has disappeared with them.
That's really what we heard. And one of the interesting things is the small group of people who we spoke to who do have secure jobs without college educations tend to be people in the military and in civil service jobs like police and firefighting. And those people have more stable, intimate relationships than other people without a college degree. So they look more like our people with college degrees in terms of the stability of their intimate relationships.
So when we talk about stability, what you're looking at is the increasing instability, lack of stability in our economy for working class people is resulting in their feeling insecure about stable long-term relationships, including marriage?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So so one of the things to think about is the literal amount of money that people have in jobs that don't require a college degree has gone down significantly since the 60s. So the minimum wage in 1968, I think, was the high point in the minimum wage. In 2011, it was $10 an hour. Well, the minimum wage now is $7.25. So the minimum wage has declined. So that's one kind of loss that people in service work, for example, face. And then, as you mentioned, union jobs have declined significantly in this country. So compared to the late 1960s, only about half as many people in the workforce have union jobs. The last figures I've seen from 2009, I think, suggested that people who have union jobs earn about $200 more per week than people who hold similar kinds of work without a union job. So that's $10,000 a year difference. Most of us know that $10,000 a year makes a big difference in what you're able to do as a family.
And one of the things that you also identify is the insecurity in number of hours that people know or have any idea that they're going to work in any given week, that you have people working. I guess one of your examples was people who work in housekeeping in hotels where they used to make maybe a fairly low wage, but they knew that they had 40 hours a week. Now that's changed.
Right. So the just-in-time mentality of industrial production has spread now to service work. So people may have a service work job in which they only learn the hours that for the week, or sometimes only for the morning of the day they're going to work. And day laborers are another example, I think, that's easy to see. People who can't make plans because they don't know how much, if anything, is coming in.
So if I'm a maid for many hotels in the country, the way the situation works these days is I call in that morning and find out if I'm going to get work that day and how many hours I'm going to get.
Right.
And what you and your colleague from Harvard were finding is that people who are, and in increasing numbers in these kinds of situations, economically insecure in the U.S., that somehow relates to their willingness to get married.
So people's ability to plan and people's sense of themselves as able to take care of themselves financially both affect their willingness to commit into long-term relationships and to take on, in some cases, the care of another person. So men and women responded differently to this problem of a lack of work as it intersects with our cultural ideas about what a marriage is. So we have this older model of the homemaker and the breadwinner, in which generally the man goes out and earns the money and the woman stays home and takes care of the household and the children. And obviously that model is predicated on the idea that the man can earn enough money to take care of himself, his wife, and the children. As these jobs, as secure, good-paying, blue-collar jobs disappear, that model can't work. So we heard a number of people we spoke to in the interviews talk about how they have nothing to offer. So men felt unable to offer the kinds of role model as a, or the kinds of resource providing that they felt they should as a man. And women responded in kind of one of two ways. So some of the women we spoke to who had working class jobs themselves, I'm thinking in particular of a woman in Massachusetts who worked in a donut shop. And she said, you know, all I want is a little house with a white picket fence and to stay home with my kids and make cookies. She said, but I can't imagine I'm ever going to meet anyone who can give me that. So I know I should go back to school and I should, you know, plan for my future by myself. But that's not what I want. So she'd graduated from high school and she was making minimum wage in this donut shop. And she was just kind of in a, you know, frozen in time or frozen in space, unable to kind of move forward with her job.
I want to give you, Sarah Kors, sociologist, a chance to tell us about the second type of reaction that you heard. But we also have standing by here from a studio in Charlottesville, psychologist Dr. Bob Emery. And I want to get you involved in this discussion, Bob, if I could. A focus of your research for a long time now has been on how family dynamics affect children specifically. You, Bob, have even written a book about your own experience of divorce and its impact on your kids. But your newest study really zeroes in on one particular area of child rearing having to do with very young children and how their development can be affected when parents living apart try to engage in some form of joint custody. Could you tell us more about this research, how it was conducted and what you found?
Sure, Tom. In many ways, I'm dealing with the fallout of all the changes that Sarah was just talking about. So many people don't live in stable, long-term relationships today, and they're faced with the very difficult question, if we're not going to be living together, how are we going to share time with our children? It's a question that parents face, of course. Our legal systems face, psychologists, mediators try to help parents to sort these things out. And, you know, not easy questions to decide for all kinds of reasons. And kind of one of the hot controversies that's popped up in the last couple of years, and you can imagine there's plenty of controversies, and by the way, plenty of people, just to put some numbers on this, 40% of children in the United States are born outside of marriage today. It's still true that almost half of first marriages end in divorce. So we're not talking about a couple of people. We're talking about huge numbers. We're talking about, you know, close to half of American families.
And this happens at much higher numbers among working class people than it does middle class or upper class incomes.
Certainly, particularly non-marital childbearing and divorce too. You know, divorce is not just divorce happens among wealthier people as well. But in all cases, and because whether you're living with somebody or married to somebody, relationships tend to break up early. People are faced more and more with questions about what do we do with our kids? What do we do particularly with our babies? How do we share custody with a one-year-old, with a two-year-old? And the range of opinion out there among experts is just enormous. There are some experts who are just an example, as a clinical psychologist, I get calls and I've gotten calls from breastfeeding mothers who've been ordered by judges to stop breastfeeding. And they call that's you're interfering with your child's relationship with his father by breastfeeding. And I've had others that say that they're sharing custody with a baby, putting a baby on an airplane and sending them, you know, hours away to divide custody.
A primary theme in our world today is that joint custody, shuttling children back and forth so they get time with both parents, is an improvement. And if I take what I read of your research, Dr. Bob Emery, correctly, one of the things that you said is we've come to this assumption without doing much research on whether it has any accuracy. So you and some of your colleagues decided to do some of that research. As you can tell from the music, we have to pause for a break, but it's only a 1 minute break. So we're going to get to the specifics of what you looked at and what you found when we continue here on Virginia Insight in just a few moments. Psychologist Bob Emery is director of the Center for Children, Family, and Law, based at the University of Virginia. He is also co-author of a new study looking at attachment issues in very young children. Sociologist Sarah Corse is also a professor at UVA. Her new study, co-authored with a colleague from Harvard, looks at how America's changing economy is affecting views toward marriage. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We were so rudely interrupted there, Dr. Emery, by the break, but let's get to what you were looking at when it comes to children, infants really, who are being shuttled back and forth between parents who are living apart because there's this theory that that's what's best for the kids.
And joint custody in most respects is a good thing. We now have the assumption that both parents should be involved in their kids' lives no matter what the family circumstances. But there's a couple of circumstances where joint custody doesn't look like it's the best situation. One, which wasn't the topic of this research, but when parents are really fighting, when you leave kids in the middle of the war zone. And then the second is just the age of the child has to be a consideration. And what we were looking at is, does, you know, frequent overnights with both parents have a positive effect, as some people would predict, for infants and toddlers, or does it actually have a negative effect, particularly on what's called their attachment relationship, that special bond that infants form between, particularly with multiple people, but particularly important with their main caregiver. And in the study, we didn't collect data. We actually analyzed data that were out there that happened to be on mainly low-income people, minorities, lots of single-parent families, and actually found support for those who were cautious about too much sharing of babies. We found that if babies had an average of one overnight a week or more with their non-resident parent, and typically that's their dad, that their rate of insecure attachment actually tripled compared to those who were seeing their dad but only having an occasional overnight, just raising lots of worries about we want to have both parents involved in their kid's life, but maybe this needs to be a more gradual process.
Psychologist Bob Emery, talk to us about what insecure attachment is and why you think it's important.
Sure. So attachment's that special bond that forms between an infant and a caregiver, like I just said. And it's really a biological process, not a psychological one. It's why ducklings swim behind mother ducks on the pond. You know, you stay close to your caregiver because that's going to help you to live. And in humans, we call that attachment. And many humans think about that as love, infant-parent love. And it's really important for infants to feel secure in that love, to know there's going to be somebody there to love, not only love them, but protect them from danger, encourage them to wander off at the same time. But when they get too far away, that person's going to be available for them. And there's decades of research, a lot of it done here at the University of Virginia by a very famous psychologist by the name of Mary Ainsworth, documenting that insecure attachments, if you have an insecure attachment early in life, it foreshadows all kinds of psychological problems later on. So it really is kind of a bedrock foundation of child development that we want, if possible, all infants and toddlers to have.
So if a toddler has an insecure attachment, one of the things that means is that little boy or little girl has difficulty trusting that somebody's going to be there for him?
That's right. Yeah, they don't have the sense that other adult is going to be available to them. And they can express that either by being very anxious and shadowing that adult around, or by being kind of angry and rejecting. It's like, nobody's going to take care of me. Whereas the child with a secure attachment, which is what we want, and sometimes people have the misconception, the child with a secure attachment is the one that's comfortable getting hugged and cuddled, but also comfortable wandering off because I know you're there.
And what you found in the study just recently completed was that very young children who spent at least one night away from their primary caregiver, and in most cases that meant a baby or a toddler spending one night away per week from its mother so that it could have an overnight with its father, that among that group of children, there was a significantly higher rate of this thing we're calling an insecure attachment.
Yes, that's right. Although, just one correction, we just found that for the babies, for the first year of life. We also did look at it among toddlers and didn't find any differences that were statistically reliable for 2 and 3 year olds. But for the 1 year old, there was a significant difference and a substantial difference in attachment insecurity for those who had frequent overnights. And even it's a particular reason for caution for me, because we had other evidence that those were the better families, that those were the, in most cases, the dads who the mom thought was a better dad and who said there was less fighting. But even so, these frequent separations were causing, you know, that attachment insecurity. Now, again, that doesn't mean that every child in that situation is going to develop an insecure attachment. About half of kids in that situation didn't. And also, not every child with an insecure attachment develops psychological problems. So somebody who's forced by a court or forced by circumstances to share frequent overnights, I don't want them to think that this is somehow an inevitability that their child's going to have psychological problems. But it's a risk factor that raises cautions, something you want to think deeply about and you know, look for alternatives if possible. Something, you know, one alternative would be moving more gradually into a shared custody situation.
Bob, can I ask you a question about whether you looked at other outcomes? Is it possible that shared custody for very young children may increase insecure attachments, but may have other benefits?
Yeah, we did look at a variety of other outcomes that were, as they were available to us. You know, one of the things, of course, that's special about measuring attachment and hard about it, everything else, is it's pretty hard to judge how a one-year-old is doing psychologically, right?
Therapy.
They don't tell us a whole lot about how they're doing. Hey, doc. But we did look at other measures of adjustment at age 3 and age 5, and we weren't finding, on the positive side, we weren't finding much one way or the other. You know, we actually did find one finding that was suggesting that more frequent overnights by the age of 3 was related to at least one index of better adjustment by age 5. So there's something more optimistic, which again gets to kind of my solution to the dilemma, is that our courts, and I think too many parents, think about we have to come up with a solution for custody arrangements. And I like to look at these arrangements much more as a living agreement that can grow and evolve along with your child's changing needs. So you can work out one thing for your 6-month-old and something different for your 4-year-old and different again for your 6-year-old and 12-year-old and so on. And I think that that's the way parents in 2-parent families, that's the way cooperative parents raise their kids in single-parent families, and that's the way I think more and more parents want to solve this dilemma.
Dr. Bob Emery, it seems to me that it's highly likely that there are some single dads listening to this who are going, now, wait a minute, here's some expert telling me that until my child passes the year of 1, I'm not supposed to spend time with him. He has to stay, or she has to stay home with the mother. And here again, somebody's trying to violate my rights as a parent. In your study, you say it doesn't matter who is the primary custodial parent, that most of the time, in reality, in the people you examined, it was the mother. But the flip side also holds true, that if the father is the one with whom the child is living, and it's the mother who only gets occasional custody of the child, that the flip side is true, that the infant needs to be having as many overnights as possible in the environment that little baby is used to, and not being shuttled back and forth between different households. But in both cases, you're saying whoever is not the primary custodial parent should be spending time with that young child during the daytime, just not taking the child away for overnights?
Yeah, so as you said, this isn't about mothers or fathers. It's possible for a dad to be the one who's taking care of the child for most of the time, and the same thing would apply to the mom in that circumstance. And no, I'm certainly not saying, as you were implying, that some might interpret that dads or the non-residential parents shouldn't be seeing their child. I want them to see their child frequently, you know, 2-3 times a week if possible, for shorter visits during the day. And I'm also not saying that there shouldn't ever be overnights during that time. Occasional overnights and really focusing on how the child reacts is something that I think it's fine for parents to experiment with. It's just what we found, again, there was, you know, kind of a threshold of around, you know, once a week or more was getting to be too frequent. And also just another thing that was kind of implicit in your tone and again, is common in the circumstances that, you know, this isn't about anybody's rights. This is about what's best for babies and for children. And this is about working together, not against your child's other parent. And, you know, the more you work together, the more options open up. If you're really working cooperatively, I'm a lot more comfortable with frequent overnights if the baby's staying in the same home and the parents are doing a little rotating back and forth during those early years. It's not about anybody's rights. It's about, let's do what's best for kids. Let's make sure kids have good relationships with both of their parents. And mostly, let's raise healthy kids for the long term.
Our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight from the University of Virginia's Psychology Department, Robert Emery, from UVA's Sociology Department, Sarah Corse. In what you've heard from them already this hour, I'm imagining that you have questions or thoughts that you might be willing to share with us. And if you do, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. We're also keeping our options open here so that if there's something that you have not heard spoken about yet, but it relates to the concept of how family is changing in America and what your concerns about that might be, we'd like to hear anything you have to say on that topic. 888-967-2825. Sarah, of course, I've heard you say before that you think that it's really difficult for many people who are not in the situation, and maybe even some who are, to understand the degree to which individuals on their own are not making decisions all by themselves. That there are cultural forces and institutional forces that most of us don't appreciate? You're nodding your head.
I think, speaking as a sociologist here, that's one of the things we hope this study can help demonstrate. The numbers tell us one important story. Divorce rates are much higher for people without a college education than they are for people with a college education. And we'd like to understand, as well as marriage rates for the educated being higher than the other. And we would like to try to understand that as a product of the confluence of cultural and economic and institutional forces, rather than thinking about it as solely a decision made by individuals who are making good choices or bad choices.
Sarah, I have a quote from you here. First of all, tell me if it's accurate, and then if you would, tell me what it means. Quote, "Our overwhelming focus on individual self-determination in this country obscures our ability to think about larger structural forces that shape people's experience," end quote.
It sounds like something I say in my Sociology 101 classes.
We've been following you around.
Americans are good about, you know, thinking about ourselves as agents in our own lives. We make choices. We can grow up to be anything we want to be. And that's got some enormous benefits, I think, for us culturally. But the flip side to it is that it's difficult for us to think about the ways in which our choices may be circumscribed by other forces. So, for example, when we're thinking about marriage, one of the things we can think about is whether marriage is supported culturally as an institution or not. So if we want to think back 50 or 60 years ago in this country, if you were Catholic, divorce was really not an option for you. As long as you were a devout Catholic, your church was probably not going to recognize your divorce. And that helps keep marriage rates higher. Now, few of us are willing to make those compromises these days. That is, we don't think marriage is just a religious bond, nor do we think marriage is just an economic arrangement for raising children. We think instead of marriage is a deeply personal, fulfilling, fundamental kind of intimacy that is something we should give up on if it's not getting us what we need. If we're married to someone we don't like, someone we don't have anything to talk to with, then we don't understand why we should stay in the marriage, except maybe for the children. So those cultural understandings of what a marriage is, you know, if we think about American frontier marriages here next to the American Museum of the Frontier, you know, marriage was, the household was the basis for an economic unit, and you needed to be married to make a household that could sustain the lives of people. Most of us don't really need that anymore. So what we look to in our marriages has kind of raised the bar. And when we went out and talked to people, all different kinds of people talked about wanting what we call a companionate marriage, a marriage that has to do with self-expression and fulfillment and true intimacy. But middle class and upper middle class people have more resources to commit to that. So people can afford therapy. People can afford to go out on date nights where they put their time and energy into each other instead of into the children. They can pay for babysitters. They can pay for restaurants. They can go on family vacations, which allow you and your spouse and your children to escape from some of the pressures of daily life and experience each other in a very positive and powerful way. But they also, our middle class respondents tended to have a lot of cultural skills that allowed them to have an investment in strong marriages. So, for instance, they spent a lot of time talking to each other, and they talked a lot about their emotions. And that's a particular kind of talk that you learn in some situations and less in other situations. So we interviewed a second-generation kid from Mexico. His parents immigrated from Mexico. He's about 20 or 21 now, and he was talking about he had ambivalent feelings about his girlfriend getting pregnant, even though they weren't married yet. And then we also interviewed his father, and his father said the most important thing about a marriage is communication. And his son sat there with his mouth hanging open and said, you know, my dad doesn't talk at all, right? So how could he make a marriage work through communication?
We're going to continue with this fascinating conversation with sociologist Sarah Corse and psychologist Robert Emery in just a bit more than 1 minute. Dr. Sarah Corse's newest study is titled Intimate Inequalities, Love and Work in a Post-Industrial Landscape. Its findings were recently presented at the annual meeting of the American Sociological Society. Dr. Robert Emery's newest study is titled Overnight Custody Arrangements, Attachment and Adjustment Among Very Young Children. It was published in a recent issue of the Journal of Marriage and Family. Among Dr. Emery's other publications, by the way, is his book, The Truth About Children and Divorce, in which he talks about his experience with divorce and its impact on his children. Bob Emery, I'm guessing that in that studio you're sitting there over in Charlottesville, you've been listening very closely to what Dr. Corse has to say, and you might have a question or comment.
Yeah, I'd like to steal your job a little bit for a second.
Please
Tom.
Do.
You know, and Sarah, you know, I don't disagree with anything you say in terms of just how hard relationships are, marriages, with the terrible economic situation that so many people face. But I do, and this is kind of strange, maybe as a psychologist talking to a sociologist, want to, you know, raise questions about, you know, marriage being all about personal fulfillment. And basically, this is where I'm coming from is, you know, I grew up 50 or 60 years ago, as you were alluding to, in, you know, a little mill town in Massachusetts. My parents hadn't gone to college. You know, all my friends' dads and mostly dads worked in the factories. And, you know, the way marriage was viewed in that time was really talk about a long-term investment. It wasn't about you, or at least that wasn't just about you. I'm sure my parents had things they didn't share with me as a child. But it was, you know, you're investing for your children. You wanted to your children to have a better life than you did. And part of the reason you stayed together and hung in there with them was you pushed education for them. And, you know, myself and my two sisters, we were the first generation of our family to go to college. And you know, so it wasn't just an investment about you. It wasn't just about, you know, getting the latest iPhone. It was about you know, and I realize I don't mean to put down, you know, some people have worries about just having enough food on the table, no doubt about it. But I also see families that I grew up with and families that I greatly admire today who are working two or three jobs, and their determination isn't about their life. Their determination is about their children's life. And, you know, all the time I'm telling parents who are going through a divorce, kind of ironically, hey, look, this isn't all about you. And I sometimes wonder, maybe we need to get that message out earlier that, you know, marriage, relationships, having kids, you know, whoever said having children was less of a commitment than being married.
I think you raise a number of really important points. And one of them, of course, is the relationship between marriage and children, right? We often conflate the two things. But so I think in this country still, just over 80% of women have children. But the number of people choosing not to have children in this country is growing. So one of the things I think we need to do is be clear when we're talking about marriage as a kind of end in itself and when we're talking about marriage as a vehicle for families. Now, most people probably don't think about it quite that analytically. But I do think that having children is a kind of a commitment that transcends marriage. That's my own opinion about that.
Transcends how? I think both you and Dr. Emery have identified that a little more than 40% of children being born in America today are being born to parents who are not married.
Right. And those kids are disproportionately born to people with less education.
And one of the things I think I was hearing in Bob Emery's question or comment was, what do we say about the degree to which somebody who has a child or children, that their first priority has to be not their own sense of fulfillment, but doing the best they can for their kids?
Well, I think it's a different case if you have children outside of marriage, right? Then what I would think people want to do is to try to bring, you know, the resources of their own family and of the two parents to bear on that children, but making the marriage work, if you're not together as a couple when the child is born, doesn't make much sense. But the question of, I agree that if one chooses to have a child or has one accidentally, one then has an enormous commitment to that child in a way that your commitment to an adult, you know, if you choose to divorce your spouse can still sustain his or herself without you. But you don't get to divorce your kids, although some people do seem to try. But the mill town that you talk about, Bob, one of the places we did some interviews was an old mill town on the banks of one of the Great Lakes. And we interviewed three generations of working class family So the middle generation was a woman in her early 40s, who we call Cindy. And Cindy grew up in this town, and her dad worked at the local factory, and her mother was a homemaker, although she sometimes did some casual labor for a little extra money. But by the time Cindy hit her 20s, the manufacturing jobs, which had accounted for 40% of the local economy, were pretty much gone. Unemployment in the town Cindy grew up in was 10 or 11%. And the ability to find jobs that paid a family wage that allow people to that stability to commit to their children in the same way weren't available. And Cindy had married and had a daughter. That marriage fell apart in part because Cindy wanted to stay home when her daughter was young. She, I think, actually wanted to have more children. Her husband was unable to find work, so Cindy was working as well as her husband. And the amount of money that he was able to bring in wasn't really enough to make the family work. So in some sense, he was not fulfilling his part of the bargain financially, and he wasn't fulfilling his part of the bargain in terms of providing the kind of emotional connection that Cindy was looking for. So they got divorced, and she and her daughter moved back in with her parents, who owned their own home. But then after her parents died, she was unable to pay the taxes on her wages as a convenience store clerk, and she lost the family house. And then she got married again, in part because she felt pretty desperate about her ability to keep herself and her daughter afloat. And that husband turned out to be abusive, so she also divorced him. And, you know, she said, I'd love to get married again, but I'm done. I'm done with men, you know, kind of more trouble than they're worth. And I think that sense that what you're getting from marriage is neither security for your family and children nor a profound emotional connection, ability to really be yourself and to be intimate with another person, underlies a lot of the divorce that we're seeing.
I wouldn't find a lot to argue with you that that's much of what does happen in marriage. And I've seen Cindy, was it? And her hometown could have been my hometown that mm-hmm. you were describing. And don't get me wrong, I'm not coming at this from a perspective of a moral perspective. You know, us liberal academics, and I count myself among the liberal academics, you know, have a hard time talking about marriage. People refer to it as the M word. It's like a dirty word. And I think, you know, I raise the question to you just because I think at the very least it's worth us having a cultural conversation. We tell people, yes, you know, it's good to, you know, put off rewards to, you know, get good education. And, you know, it's also, I think, thinking about marriage in terms of, you know, some people call it commitment, but it's easier to talk about it in economic terms as long-term investment is something that I think is, again, worth talking about from a variety of ways. One being that, you know, maybe the short-term payoff isn't always as good, but again, the long-term payoff and thinking about children as a long-term payoff is, if nothing else, is something that, you know, I want to raise because, as I said earlier, this is how I talk to my own five kids. I want to talk to other people's kids at using the same way. And if I could just to bring up one thing, you said agreeing with me that if you have a child, that certainly is a long-term commitment. And I agree with that completely, that you're obligated to that child in all kinds of ways. But something I spend an awful lot of my time telling people is if you have a child with somebody else, which is pretty much how you're going to have one, you not only have a long-term commitment to that child, but you've all of a sudden, in a way, married that other person, whether you've married them or not, you know, because they're going to be there when you exchange the child. They're going to be there for the school plays, for the soccer games, for graduations. Or as I just did with my daughter from my first marriage 2 years ago, you know, her mom and I put on her wedding together. So that other person is a part of your life if your children are going to be a part of your life, because that's something precious that you both share. So again, I'm not trying to, even though I know I sound like I'm lecturing, it's an occupational hazard, I guess. But I'm not coming at this from a moral point of view, but just that I think it's a conversation that we need to have. This is why, by the way, I'm a proponent of same-sex marriage. I'm a proponent of marriage generally. Not that you have to, but it's a commitment that I think we all should take seriously and do our best to support.
Psychologist Bob Emery is director of the Center for Children, Family, and Law, based at the University of Virginia. He is also co-author of a new study looking at attachment problems in very young children. Sociologist Sarah Corse is also a professor at UVA. Her new study, co-authored with a colleague from Harvard, looks at how America's changing economy is affecting views toward marriage. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Sarah, earlier in the program, you were telling us about the lady who works in the donut shop and yearns for the small home, the white picket fence, and being able to stay home and bake cookies for her children. And you said that was one of two views that you had run into. Was the story you told us about Cindy the second view, or is there another story that represents the second view?
Yeah, I think Cindy is a good example of first. She had the first view, right? She wanted a life similar to her parents' life, and she was unable to get that because her first husband couldn't find stable work. She also couldn't find stable work. One could imagine that if she could find a stable job, then he could stay home, but neither of them could find stable work. And then she moved to the second, which is
I'm done with men,
which is we think of as the kind of defensive position. So common in our interviews with middle class people is an expression, especially by women, of home, of family life, as marriage, as a haven from the pressures and the difficulties of the outside world, and a place where, you know, even if things aren't going great at work, they might be going very well in your family. Our working class people were much less likely to be able to find that. For many of them, intimate relationships were another threatening or dangerous risk. So we spoke to a man who's currently working as the manager at a retail shop. He actually has finished his college degree, but it took him a number of years to finish, and he borrowed a lot of money in order to finish his college degree. And then he couldn't get a job using his college degree, so he's working in a service job, though it's a better job than many people. But he says, you know, by the time he pays his student loans every month, he barely has enough money for rent. And he says, you know, who wants to come sit on a couch and watch TV and eat takeout food from Burger King? You know, I don't have anything to offer a relationship. I'm used up in some sense, financially, but also emotionally, trying to manage my disappointment, and he's trying to figure out whether he should borrow even more money and go back to school and get a master's.
Bob Emery, in your work, both as a research psychologist, as the director of the Center for Children, Family, and Law, and as a clinical psychologist, you meet a lot of people who have a lot of different stories about their experience with relationships, with marriage, and with children. I'm curious, one, if you're identifying with anything that Sarah is saying as things that you've heard before, and two, if both in your study and the work that Sarah's doing, if there are policy implications here. And I'm sorry, we've only got a minute left. So you choose which part of the question to answer.
To solve the world's problems in 60 seconds.
That'd
no
be
problem,
good,
you know?
Yeah.
So first of all, I want to say that I think the work that Sarah is doing is terrific. And I'm pushing her not because I don't like the work. I'm pushing her because I love the work. And think this has just been a lot of fun for me, and I hope for the listeners to have this conversation. So congratulations, Sarah, and I look forward to meeting you in person.
Thank you.
Policy-wise, we just, it's not just families that I worry about not investing in kids. It's, you know, our society in general needs to invest in kids. And again, we talk a lot. We need to invest for the long term. I'm not sure we always do that, but there is no bigger long term investment, whether you're talking about education or health and well-being or families, than investing for our kids. Pollution, the environment. And so I think that's where we as a society and we as individuals need to put our focus.
And Sarah, the biggest headline takeaway from you is getting people to understand that there are sort of institutional and cultural forces that act upon us that it would be good to give some consideration to before we start making judgments about how others are making choices.
A plus in Soch 101.
I'm going to have to take that course. Our guests have been Sarah Corse, co-author of the new study, Intimate Inequalities, Love and Work in a Post-Industrial Landscape, and a professor of sociology at the University of Virginia, plus the director of the Center for Children, Family, and Law at UVA, professor of psychology, Robert Emery. His new study is titled Overnight Custody Arrangements, Attachment and Adjustment Among Very Young Children. Bob, Sarah, thank you both so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You can find postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you get there, you will find links to more information about the work that both Dr. Corse and Dr. Emery are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.